All right, everyone. Welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's March 6th, 2024. My name is Eric Kosterman. I'm going to be your host. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for funded startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by using our 200 plus Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. So if you're curious, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. Book a meeting with me directly and we'll see if we can move the needle for you. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. If you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's office hours valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse and find the video there, or maybe share a short testimonial about the value you're getting. So with that said, let's jump into this week's announcements. Got a lot on my radar here. So the first one is something that just caught my eye this morning HashiCorp's estimated price per share of 0.5 beat the estimates of analysts. Now, it's not a whopping success, but it is nice to see that as a business, they're not tanking. And we want HashiCorp to succeed. Like, it is bad, bad, bad for our business, for everyone's business, if HashiCorp goes under. So anyways, hope they continue to improve. Surprising was just how low the income is, though, for the HCP, HashiCorp cloud platform. I mean, the majority of their income, therefore, is coming from all of their product licenses with an average of 100K ARR per license. So, any commentary on that?
Just the question of why do you feel like we need HashCorp to succeed?
I think because it's going to be a long time before trust and and reputation is established with OpenTofu as a young project. We need a mature corporate backer of Terraform out there, and there's a lot of education that has to happen with tools and languages and things like Terraform. And HashiCorp obviously has a vested interest in advertising, promoting, educating on the usage of Terraform, why you need it, and so forth. Obviously, for most people on this call, it's a foregone conclusion. Everybody there's no question about doing it. I think also it's really good for OpenTofu. Because what do we see happening now between OpenTofu and HashiCorp? I don't know if it's a coincidence. I know sometimes gym memberships are always higher at the beginning of the year as everyone has a resolution to get back to work. Well, it seems like HashiCorp has a resolution to get back to work on Terraform because they are really starting to release new features again with Terraform and moving it forward. So we have more announcements on that as well. What happened here with my screen here? Weird.
That was a legit answer, and I agree with all that. I was wondering what you would say in that regard, because you seemed pretty adamant. And I agree. I think that long term, I hope that it's not all based around one company, and that like the community can be a thing that supports both. But I'm loving to see the competition, so I can't say that I'm want HashiCorp to fail in any way either. So, yeah, them doing well is great. I sold my shares, which I'm okay with. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Answer. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a strategic, financially recommended approach to invest in HashiCorp right now. But hey, you can be an early bull in buying it. What I was going to say is also imagine, like, let's take the counter argument. Like, if it does fail, that would sow tremendous doubt on Terraform, on all this, material that we have out there, and put all that burden on this young project, OpenTofu. Obviously, I don't know what you call it, but a pressure balloon or whatever, that would put a lot of pressure and direct a lot of attention and help Tofu grow quickly. But I think it would be do tremendous damage on the reputation of Terraform if that were to happen. All right, next announcement: Amazon goes nuclear. They have just acquired their first data center that is 100% powered by nuclear energy. That's all I got there.
Yeah, I think if you look at the size and scale of that, they have an option to, I think, eventually get up to 2.5 gigawatts. Yeah, there it is. Or no. They have 900 and something. They can do 900 and something megawatts to be powered from that thing. I think they can ramp it up to, they can option to cap it off at 480, but I think they have the ability to ramp it to 900 and whatever it is, 960 megawatts at the time, which is just an absolutely enormous amount of power. Oh yeah, there it is. 960 megawatt data center. So, I mean, if you actually look at how much that is, like, in comparison, just to, give you some, like, long background. I mean, back, I used to work for a data center building company. We worked in Phoenix. We built a data center that was 100,000 square feet. Jeez, I can't speak. And it was, and that was only 100 megawatts. So, like, this is the equivalent of, like, almost 10 of those. So that would be, like, essentially, like, almost 5 million, square feet of data center space that they could essentially build out using that kind of power at, like, normally dense, densely conditioned power and cooling, rates. And so that's somewhat dated. So maybe it's like half that, but we're still talking like 2 to 3 billion square feet of data center space. I mean, that you could build up with that amount of power. That's like a gigantic data center, probably the biggest commercial data center in the world if they actually built that out.
Yeah, this raises a lot of questions. Speaking from the industry here, why in the world would you do this? I think there's probably a lot. I'm going to look into this because I want to understand what's going on here. There's an awful lot of reasons why you would not want to do this when you understand how power plants work. Yes, we used to build power plants next to aluminum smelters, and there were reasons even then that the aluminum smelter did not build the power plant. There's a very good business explanation for why you should not do that. You should have some other entity run it. And it's even more so when you deal with a nuclear plant, because nuclear plants shut down casually for any reason whatsoever. Safety is paramount. So anyway, well, this raises an awful lot of questions.
What do you mean by shut down casually? I thought it was a massive operation to shut down a nuclear plant for any reason.
The choice to shut down is made easily.
Oh, gotcha.
As opposed to the choice to shut down a lignite plant, a coal plant, there's severe repercussions to shutting down that plant. So when you punch the unit out for safety, you are acknowledging that hitting the button, which, it's not as simple as that, but the making that decision is a $2.5 million decision.
Yeah.
No matter what else happens from this time forward, if you shut it down, it costs money to turn it back on. And so in addition to your losses, your profits, everything else, that's real capital that goes into just turning the engine back on. So there's a little more caution amongst businesses to decide to punch a unit out than there is in the nuclear arena, because there the profit is not the motive. Public safety is the motive. But in general, you know, a 300 person coal ignite plant that's sitting in the middle of nowhere, you know, Texas, doesn't face the question of public safety. So it's you don't punch the unit out quite as quickly. You might be dealing with local injuries, death, damage to the unit. It's not as clear a public safety issue. It is absolutely a safety issue, and we have safety culture, but you know the weight of the decision to punch that unit out for $2 or $3 million. A nuclear plant wouldn't care. They don't care how much it's going to cost. They shut it down if the right thing to do is to shut it down. They don't even hesitate. So anyway, this raises a lot of questions. I'll be following this.
Interest, basically, and public safety, that that if Amazon is running this plant, they're financially hamstrung.
Amazon is not running the plant. Oh, okay. It's someone like Talon Energy still runs the plant, but the data center facility is next to the plant. But I think what we're saying is they could easily, like, their power source is not as commercially stable as like other sources of energy would be, because like the first you know, the first choice would be to turn off the power that it's generating if there were any kind of safety issue arising. And that does happen, you know, from time to time.
Yeah. And the reality is most nuclear plants are run by private entities. So the same issue arises. That's a whole separate topic. It's interesting, though. It is really fascinating for why Amazon would do this at all. It raises a lot of questions.
I think they would do it just because they have access to that power. The problem is you can't find that kind of like power on a commercial power grid. Like, you would literally need a power company to commit to diverting a significant portion of their grid to building a local substation for you to deliver anywhere near the kind of power that they're talking about. And, you know, in the Phoenix market, 100 megawatts, you know, at the time was like a major build that took like years to get them to drop in the back, you know, in the back of the data center that we built out there, et cetera, et cetera. So I can only imagine what it would take to find that kind of power on any kind of grid, like in the US.
You know, if this go on.
It energy is commodity. So it's traded, you know, on the grid, so to speak. So this has got to be part political and part financial. They have to get preferential, lower cost per megawatt is what they are getting out of it, but it's a gamble.
If this had happened a few years ago, I would have guessed this would be Bitcoin related. They were getting into mining, but now I guess this has got to be AI driven.
The GPUs for all the AI stuff take up like huge amounts of power, and I mean it's the same GPUs that were doing the Bitcoin mining are now powering all these all this AI stuff.
It's stunning. I think in Texas they talk it's like 5% of the energy usage is crypto. So they were trying to work deals with different crypto providers to scale back, like they do with your home AC units, that on demand Texas, the TRE was trying to convince operators that they would give them perks to scale back their crypto operations during extreme weather. Anyway, off topic. Sorry, gentlemen.
Oops. Wrong slide there. There we are. Very interesting. All right. So the next one. I'm sharing it not so much because I find it interesting, the announcement. I can't believe this is where we're at now. Like, now you need firewalls for your AI. And my head had never even gone there. So Cloudflare is announcing an offering that somehow will, I guess, restrict the kind of data that comes in and out of some AI model, but I don't know, understand it more than that. I haven't fully researched that.
Have you heard of it's like prompt. It's you can basically back or there's a term for it, but you have you seen like the OpenAI the prompt hacks where you can get OpenAI to do things that not supposed to happen. I'm assuming this is in regards to that based off my quick skim here, but
interesting.
Seems like a hard problem to solve though.
Prompt engineering is dead. I was just reading something I forgot to share. It was this one here. I thought it was interesting, but it made me think of it based on what you said. When, you know, for the last 6 months or so, it's been a big thing about engineering, like designing the actual prompt to get the answers that you want out of the AI system. And this article goes into some interesting research that they did where that prompt engineering is a dark art, if you will, where that prompt that you come up with might actually help solve one situation to make the AI give more intelligent responses, but in a slightly different situation actually cause the AI to perform worse. So here they've done some research and shown how getting the AI systems through an iterative process to come up with its own prompts yields better results ultimately. So I think it's interesting as we get, are we getting to another higher order of abstraction over the AI where you're training systems that are used to just ask questions of AI in a AI format? Format's the wrong term, but in a way that games how the AI system works.
So there's a thing called agents, and I haven't played around with it myself. I saw this at a recent local Python meetup in SoCal, and you can have the AI, you can like create these agents. And so think of a typical software development lifecycle. You probably have a product manager, a QA, and you have a software engineer, and then you basically give it a prompt, and then you have all three of those agents working together and asking each other questions. And it's pretty cool. I haven't used it myself, but
so ChatGPT just added that ability where in one chat you can refer to another one of your custom GPTs using an at sign, almost like an agent. I never thought, I'm not sure if it's supported, but I never thought of kind of like, hey, you ask you, and they're two different models talking to each other.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy because all it's really doing is predicting the next word, right? And then I don't know if you've used it much for coding yourself, but I've literally just thrown error messages in it, and I'm like, hey, it doesn't work, doesn't work. And then eventually it just works. I'm like, sweet. And you're at it for like 15, 20 minutes, but you're like, still worth it.
It's been phenomenal for me. This is the perfect, you know, there's been all these platforms over the years that have promised like no code experiences. And okay, so there's one benefit to those no-code platforms is you often don't have to pay the tech debt tax to upgrade them because that's happening behind the scenes. But other than that, it's a bit tedious to go through these UIs and select and click and connect things. So using the co-pilots like built into VS Code, it's just been amazing for me as somebody who's not day-to-day getting to program too much as I'm running Cloud Posse. But I've enjoyed made it. It's made it so much fun for me to get things done.
What have you been doing in that regard, if you don't mind me asking, Eric? Like, it sounds like you're replacing Zapier workflows with just what, prompt engineering a full automation solution out really quickly?
Well, I mean, there are lots of little things here. One of them is a strategic project on the back end I'm not going to talk about right now on the call. But like most recently, for example, for the last week, we need to perform a migration on all of our GitHub repositories, updating certain files, certain things there. And the whole thing, everything I've done has just come from intelligently interacting with the GPT. Now, I have a very formal, strong programming background, just it's dated. And this is helping me. I can dust that off and still intuit what these things should do and identify problems so it works for me like that. And I wouldn't have been able to get all these things done because I don't focus as much time anymore programming. So one thing was, using some Python YAML parser to update fields of a README YAML, which is turns out to be absolutely non-trivial, because YQ loses white space, loses comments, reformats multi-line strings. So, having to deal with that and find a parser or YAML library that would work with that was tricky. Other things, writing GitHub actions. Composite actions have been a really effective usage of those. So I have three actions that do what I want it to do. Okay, glue those together, give me one composite action that now combines all that and gives me the output that I need. It's been very effective for that. Those are two recent.
Fine-tuning ChatGPT, whether it's ChatGPT or one of these LLMs, against all the Cloud Posse modules?
Yeah, so it's definitely that would be a passion project. We really want to do something like that. We've been loosely playing around with it with Atmos and training it on our documentation and stack configs with the custom GPTs. Like with anything, you get out of it what you put into it. So it's great that you can more easily train GPTs now, uploading that data without having to be a savant at AI. You can literally just upload the data set, but then you still have to kind of train it with some prompt engineering so that you can tune the responses in a meaningful way. So yeah, I would love to do it on the whole Cloud Posse ecosystem. That'd be phenomenal. And Atmos.
Real quick, just going back to the Cloudflare firewall for AI. I'm Andrew Madsen, and I'm an MLOps engineer at Pluralsight. We are working on some experiences around LLMs, and one of the challenges that we have had is that it's pretty easy when you're using function calling from like OpenAI or some of these other things to actually trick the model into exposing like what its functions are that it can call, what their signatures are, that type of stuff. And so I think this is a useful addition to help prevent abuse. The other thing is like, it can be scary to put like a more expensive model, like a GPT-4 or something similar out there, because if you get DDoSed, the potential expense in tokens of getting DDoSed could be astronomical. And so it's interesting to see like some of the features here of like the DDoS and the firewall with the request validation and response validation. Like from my lens, like those seem like much needed features in this space.
Good points. Yeah, thanks for adding that color.
It also brings up the topic of things that I talk about all the time is like architecting your applications properly. So things like when you have abnormally gigantic surges of traffic, like having circuit breakers that don't automatically flood your upstream or downstream services because of that is also good software engineering and would help prevent things like that without needing a commercial service. But I hear you. Like that makes a lot of sense for the people who aren't doing those types of things to get some protection around that stuff.
What is the current state of art though for like, so I agree with that statement in sentiment, but naively one can implement circuit breakers with like Memcache or Redis or things like that. But what is the state of the art right now for doing circuit breakers? Does Cloudflare offer anything that make that simpler from an application perspective?
I think more so like the service meshes that most people are running like on Kubernetes and the like are the tools that really help you do those kinds of things.
Makes sense.
Yeah. At least, I haven't investigated it in a while, so I don't know if there are any kind of off cluster solutions that help with that kind of thing.
Yeah. All right, the next announcement is an interesting one. So you'll recall maybe a few months ago, we announced how Google was suspending any egress charges for customers migrating out of GCP. And one of the conspiracy, or there were a couple conspiracy theories, it's overusing conspiracy here, but there were a couple alternative explanations for why they were doing that. One was to force Amazon to do the same thing. And two was pending legislation in EU that would necessitate them doing this. So rather than wait for them to be legislated, get out ahead of it and make it PR worthy announcement. So what this means is if you have those petabytes of data on AWS and now you want to move that to GCP or Cloudflare or R3 or something, you can do that more affordably.
Yeah, and this is 100% because the EU and the UK have mandated that they need to be able to move to every, all cloud providers need to provide you like free ability to migrate to a competitor, or else they consider you anti-competitive, and then, you know, then they're going to investigate you for it. So that's why they're going this route.
Well, note also that they did this, but if you read the fine print, you have to, you're covered up to like 100 gigs already, but you have to actually open a support request and request this.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, how do you distinguish between regular egress and egress due to migration?
Yeah.
I think it's maybe you just answered it for me, Eric, but like for both of them, what Google Cloud is doing, what AWS is now doing, it is purely only egress is free if you're migrating. It's not that egress is free.
Right.
Right? Okay. I just wanted to confirm that because I feel like... Oh, go ahead.
Well, but I think many of the providers offer already today free ingress and charge...
Ingress, yeah.
Yeah.
So... This is potentially massive if you consider vendors like R2 under Cloudflare or Blaze that have promised substantially lower cost for storage and so on. I mean, if the reason that we didn't spend any time considering them when they called us was, yeah, this is all great. You have a lower price. But it's very costly to move petabytes of data to you, so there's no point. If AWS has to let us move that data, you know, quote, for free, or at least not with egregious costs, that could be an enormous change.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think Cloudflare has been waiting for this day for some time. As they wrote Slurper, I remember we announced that years ago, to just ingest everything. So
I looked at this, you know, back when it occurred, but it was like if you're paying AWS to run the Slurper, no big deal. But suddenly this means we need to go back and consider R2 and Backblaze in a way that we did not realistically consider them before.
Agree. Yeah.
Wow, that's big.
Also big for anybody doing AIML, I presume, who have these massive models stored in S3, they can now go to the cloud provider du jour, offering them the best price. All right, next announcement is interesting. So in the financial sector, we'll know that, you know, for money laundering reasons, they introduce these, you know, your customer laws. So, you know, make it a little bit harder for the drug dealers of the world, money or weapons dealers to bank there. Now, this is something being proposed for infrastructure providers. That they know a little bit about the customers using their cloud and for what purpose. You could think back in the day when Pirate Bay was a thing. Obviously, that's, you barely hear about it anymore, but to prevent those kinds of things. And then there's all the dark side of the web I don't even want to get into, that this would help.
Yeah. Or so you can easily identify companies who are publishing content that you don't agree with, and as the government step in and shut it down.
True, true. It is. And I know another country that does that. They're very effective at it.
You mean Twitter?
China.
Before Elon Musk bought it?
No, China. Like, yes. In order to have anything online, you got to register and have
those systems. I was not being facetious when I was saying how Twitter was behaving, you know, prior to the acquisition. So, it's a little scary. And it's also like, I understand it from a, from sort of a safety perspective. Like, I guess it makes sense, but like, until you've broken the law, like having people who are like having the government keeping tabs on who's running things in certain in certain data centers and what the purposes of it is and what their traffic patterns look like and the technology that they're using and all of that starts making me a little bit nervous, just given recent track records that I've seen.
Not a bad argument. All right. Any other commentary on that before we move on?
I'm wondering if rate limits will get easier once they do KYC, if they'll still make you jump through hoops to get higher, like more quota, I guess, from AWS or Linode.
Somehow I don't think they're going to be connected with each other.
That's my one hope. If I have to submit additional documents like government ID, passport. The other thing around KYC, you mentioned for fintech, all the crypto exchanges are obviously doing it, which is kind of annoying if you have crypto and you're trying to get your money back. But
are you trying not to pay taxes on it, you mean? No.
No. So the problem, I don't know, not to derail on crypto, but some of these fintech companies, these crypto exchanges, have implemented KYC after they already accepted US citizens. And so, or at least in my case. And so now I have like crypto assets stuck and I have to figure out how to exchange it or figure out how I can do KYC without breaking any rules. And then on that note of KYC, I heard that the AI tech has progressed quite a bit where it can fool KYC. And I'm not sure underneath which circumstances, but apparently people are able to do, I guess there's what they're, I don't know what the correct term is. I'm going to assume black hat LLMs or black hat AI models. That you can generate apparently fake IDs, like I'm thinking McLovin from Superbad, but I'm not sure to what degree, but apparently they could fool KYC. That was according to the articles that I came across.
Yeah, in a previous life, I used to do a bunch of business with a company called Jumio, J-U-M-I-O, and they actually make very, very sophisticated, like, ID verification software that's like underneath the hood of a lot of these things. And I've kind of kept up with them and they seem like they've done a lot in keeping up with kind of the black hat efforts to try to do these things. But they have some crazy like identity verification software that does like amazingly accurate verification from what I've seen. So I don't own any of the business. I did work with them before. They were pretty good leaders in that area from my personal knowledge.
All right. Next topic, test containers. I found it by way of seeing this announcement that Atomic Jar is now part of Docker. But conceptually, it really resonated with me. I like it. It's a practice that we've recommended to a lot of customers. When you are trying to do like ephemeral environments, preview environments for every pull request, how do you spin up the backing services? You don't want to spin up an RDS database for every pull request. It's cost prohibitive. It's very slow and isn't what you need to test at that stage. So what do? Well, you use a container. It seems easy enough. However, how do you get the data into that? How do you get all the fixtures there? And then how do you do that for the 10 other things that you depend on? This is also incidentally, you know, kind of the use case for LocalStack, specializing in some of the services that the cloud providers themselves offer. Now, if you just have open source dependencies on common things like RabbitMQ, Kafka, so forth, well then test container has a container for you. and it's an open source project. So I'm pretty excited if that'll help simplify some of these things we've had to, you know, jimmy rig ourselves. Has anybody used test containers? This project or framework?
Yeah, I have used them. You can run into some issues, though. I mean, they really work really well when they do work, which is most of the time. But sometimes you have some weird gremlins that come up. And however, they have a Slack that was very, very helpful. Hopefully that continues now that they're part of a bigger thing.
Could you clarify what those issues you ran into were, Isaac? Was it just environmental, or was it like an issue with, like, yeah, just curious if you clarify, if you don't mind.
Oh yeah, it's like when you have a test. Well, the idea is, sorry, I need to mute my Slack. The idea is you use it for your unit or integration test, and the issues we would have would be in some flaky test, and the had to do with the test not being able to communicate with either the database or the Kafka queue that is from test containers. But then it's hard to tell, especially when you're running this inside like a CI that is also in a container, and so just with that whole setup it gets tricky. It's been a while and we actually didn't solve it, we gave up. So that's how hairy it was, and we elected to run them differently.
Got it. It sounds like, for example, you're expecting a database to be online, but it wasn't online in time, correct? And then the test would probably fail.
And that's part of it, yeah.
Got it. Cool. That makes sense. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, so me hopping on my soapbox again. Don't use dependencies in your unit tests. That's an anti-pattern. Like, you should have mock dependencies that you could pass into unit tests that don't require real things in the real world that have side effects. Integration tests, whole different story. But if you're doing unit tests, I mean, maybe in some corner case things, like if you're unit testing things that stand up, like, you know, stand up infrastructure, you probably can't help but have real world things in there. But if you're writing like standard application development and you're writing unit tests, you should have interfaces that all of your dependencies adhere to. You pass in a mocked version for all of your unit tests. Not only will your unit tests run much quicker, but they'll also not fail. They'll be much more stable because you can control the states of all your mocked objects that you're passing in as dependencies rather than real things as dependencies. So
that's absolutely valid. I'm using the term unit loosely here because we have a different definition in terms of unit being like a unit of like a flow of productivity. And we also have like, this is a different conversation. We have our own challenges with mocks and reliance of them. But yeah, this, our unit, when I say unit, it's more like an integration test. That's why I try to like quickly correct myself and say integration.
Gotcha.
For most people, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
This is really cool. So then, and then on top of that, then they have a cloud service similar to LocalStack where you don't have to then run those containers yourselves. You can just, you know, make a call and have access to it. Were you using the free self-hosted model, or were you using the paid service? Just curious.
Nope, the full open source model.
Okay. Cool.
And then you can use, what's the other, the tool we were just talking about, Eric? Pilot, right? The database extraction and anonymization tool.
I think it was called something different though.
No, not Pilot. Pivot? I don't know. It starts with a P. I can't think of the name of it, but
are you talking about Snaplet?
No.
No. There's a tool that exists that basically will take like your production data, anonymize it, and let you grab subsets of it. And then it one of its options is the output of Tonic, that's it. I don't know why I thought of it. And one of the options is that you can direct the output of that to a container, essentially. So you can basically then just point to the container and mount that volume, mount that as a volume, and use that in your testing frameworks to actually test things like with real data. It's pretty cool how it all works.
Yeah, we use a similar tool that's only for Postgres. It's called Snaplet. And that has been, it's pretty nice. But yeah, have you folks used Tonic? Do you like it? Does it work for more than Postgres?
We have a customer that's using it currently that's in the healthcare industry. And I think it works with several solutions. But I could be wrong. It might only be Postgres.
Cool. Anyway, interesting.
But the concept of being able to carve out pieces of production like data into a container and then actually just run that container. And I was thinking, like, if you could pair this with the other solution we were just talking about, that could make for some interesting like test environments for you.
So it looks like it supports MySQL, Postgres, just, you know, doing some keyword searching there. Jonathan?
Just want to do a quick review on the cost for a Tonic-like solution. We've been approached by a couple of companies like these, and they seem very cool, but they also have very oof-diddy price tags associated. Is this an inexpensive capability, or is this one where you're really paying dearly?
I know there's I know there's like a pretty small priced free, like not free tier, but like getting started tier, but I don't know how much that really gets you after that. So
whenever we've been approached by these companies, it starts glorious and it's so beautiful. And then their entry price tags are 50K for, you know, and it's like, you're getting very high on at least our price list for this one rifle shot capability.
Yeah, if you look on the screen, like they're actually saying it's $200 a month for your first 20 tables and then $20 a table after that. So that seems pretty reasonable to me.
Oh, they
unless
do have
you have, I'll have to yeah, unless you have thousands of tables, I guess, then it becomes expensive. But like, you know.
Not yet.
Yeah.
And I would say we chose Snaplet because my client was concerned about uploading their data somewhere, and Snaplet basically it is just creating a slim down snapshot that's allows you to be filtered and masked and do all of those different pieces. So you can host that snapshot wherever you want. So we just ended up creating the snapshot, uploading it to S3, and then we created like a little bit of task file tooling around pulling those snapshots. So we did that completely free where we're not paying for the tool it's just engineering hours, which engineering hours are definitely not nothing, but I feel like you can do it without a 50K price tag. It just depends on how many databases you're actually looking to support and all of that.
Yep, that makes sense.
All right, moving on down. Let's see, time check. Oh, wow, taking our time here. Well, next announcement I'm really excited about. HashiCorp announces beta 1 of 1.8, which adds something that is very transformational for Terraform as a language. Terraform in some ways reminds me of PHP back in the day. PHP had, you know, 200-300 functions in the global space that you can call. Arguably one of the reasons PHP was successful, it was easy to get started with. You spent a lot of time hacking it to get it to do what you wanted it to do. And I've just described Terraform in a nutshell. Terraform, you're always trying to come up with hacks and how it works with the limited set of functions that are available. And when there wasn't a function available, you could write a provider, and then that provider could expose like a data source or a resource that you can do to perform some operation. Only thing is those data, if you're using Terraform on a regular basis, You know, modules are like functions, but they don't feel like functions. Data sources are like that. Resources are like that, but they're not. Functions, you know, when if you want to do string concatenation or formatting, that's what we're talking about when we have a function here. So now, instead of waiting forever for HashiCorp to come around and actually agree to introducing a new function, now providers can do that. One of the things that we were waiting on forever was deep merging support, for example, inside of Terraform. But for one reason or another, they have, I mean, and it's a tremendously upvoted issue, they just do not see it as a need or a priority. So we ended up writing our own provider with a data source to do deep merging in Terraform. Now that can just be a function, and we can finally support native deep merging in Terraform. And there are a lot of other use cases for using these functions instead of having to use a data source. Yeah. I believe one of the interesting use cases here is also more freely or easily requesting secrets from different providers, different kind, like string formatting. Terraform dropped support for that. You can only render templates from an actual file. So now you can have a template string function exposed from a provider.
I can't wait for the 37 implementations of, you know, two upper and snake case and all the other things. Whose should I choose? Which one will be the best one?
Yeah.
That's the only problem with this.
That's not unique. I mean, bring up any mainstream programming languages and there's, two dozen ways of doing a thing. I do like it when there's fewer ways, so long as they support my way, the one I want.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. The canonical way is always better than some plugin in my book, but yeah.
Yeah.
Give us some functionality. The only thing I really hate about this is that you also have to write a provider to do this. So if you just come up with a function that you want on the fly, that means you have to then add it to a provider if you want to be able to use it.
Yeah, I mean, it would be pretty nice if there was a native support for like user space defined functions in HCL. But who knows, maybe this is getting there.
I feel like y'all should build the Lodash, like build that, provider that actually has all the really good utils that would be super useful, because I feel like, yeah, you're right, there will be 37 of those, right? But the being first to it and the Cloud Posse name, I feel like has a good connection for being one of the more used ones, where a good bag of functions that I could bring into my, code would be great. And then, I say this and I got excited about this. And then I also, and I don't know if anybody else just like wars with themselves about this, but like one of the things, and it's just continually, it's just down the slippery slope further and further, but like, as we make, as we introduce more logic, as we introduce more programming like features into Terraform, into the language or what's supported by the framework, we get further and further away from this being declarative. Whereas like I rail against people who are like, yeah, I really love using Pulumi because I can use all my for loops and all that stuff. And I hear them, but then I'm also like, but you're able to do whatever the hell you want in an imperative language. So you give yourself this huge foot gun. And I don't know. I feel like I could go on a rant for that about that for a while. So I'll pull myself back. But as we add this, I feel like we're just going to see more and more complicated Terraform code that feels we'll get more things done, but like we will have more complicated projects and we have to kind of still find that balance. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah. If you want to have that debate someday, we can, I'll take the counterpoint and we can have the Matt versus Matt debate on imperative versus, versus non-imperative for infrastructure code, because I've thought about this a lot and I'm actually strongly on the other side, to despite what I'm doing in my day job every day.
Yeah. And I think we should do that, because the thing is that I also understand the other side, and I'm like, I could be really into it, but then I think the quality of actual engineering depends on if Imperative can be successful. Like, if your team knows how to write solid code, yeah, you could do great things with an Imperative infrastructure as code language. But if you're like 80% of the, you know, prospects and clients and teams that I've seen, you could really, yeah, build a hot mess. So we'll save it for the debate. Yeah. Maybe we'll do a special Cloud Policy Office Hours on that.
And I'll just quickly say, your statement there at the end implies that somehow by using Terraform, you haven't seen people who have just made a mess of it.
Solid point. Solid point.
Yeah. So it'll be an interesting chat for sure.
Yeah. Nena, can you remind me that we talked about that maybe next week if we have time?
Yeah, sure.
Thanks. All right, next announcement. Okay, and that feature is planned for OpenTofu as well. OpenTofu obviously is still coming up to speed and doesn't have the velocity of HashiCorp Terraform right now. But there's a video showing an initial implementation of it. I haven't personally watched it, so check that out. Related to that is another thing making its rounds on Twitter, is a preview of the forthcoming local state encryption support in OpenTofu, slated for 1.7 release. This is really exciting. It's a long requested feature to ensure that the state leaves your workstation or your CI pipeline fully encrypted and precludes manipulation of that state once it's in the S3 bucket, sure, or what your state backend, whatever that is. So, you know, that takes me perfectly to the next post, which was perfectly timed with all of these things and has been getting some good attention because of it, which is someone has shown how Terraform apparently doesn't reconcile your desired state in HCL fully with the desired state, with the actual state recorded in the state file. So through manipulation of that state file, they've shown you can cause resources to get created that actually were never created. Can't believe it works that way. That is what they've shown here. But that's that's one of the big arguments for why this state encryption is so critical, because it prevents or precludes that remote manipulation if you don't have access to the key. And right, security is always the defense in depth and different layers. So now you have to also compromise the key in order to compromise the state.
I wonder if something, tools like Spacelist would still show you those resources in that fancy graph it has. But I mean, at the same time, who actually goes and checks those?
So. Well, I mean, that's just being able, I mean, you can still do that. Spacelift can still do that. You just have to set up the trust relationship so whoever needs to report on that has access to the state. It also opens up interesting situations where you don't need to now secure your state bucket to the same degree necessarily. Like if you're doing cross account sharing of state, in like S3 buckets. Now, you obviously want to keep it secure, but maybe you can open up access to it and restrict access instead to KMS keys, for example.
I mean, if you have local encryption, then my next follow-on is why don't you just use Git for state? I mean, I know you can't, but that would be the ideal, right? I mean, we already have a distributed state system that reconciles differences, that you know keeps version history, that does, you know, all the different things. Like, it seems like the perfect place to then store state if everything is encrypted.
I mean, because you would need it to be so that, hey, my changes to state locally are pushed somewhere central immediately. Like, it's like a database, right? Well, where it would need to be, it can't be that you're checking that file in manually. Maybe if it was fully like an automated, you know, you do a plan and it does it git checkout and it, you know, does a commit when you do an apply, then all of that would work. And it was like kind of managed for you outside of your hands, but you couldn't have it actually checked into the repo where your Terraform code is being planned and applied. Right.
Now, I guess I could totally see why you can now with this change. I mean, so like, what is one of the big reasons why? Okay, so a few things. Let's level set. So one of the reasons we have state backends is for the reasons you described, because it's also pain, because you don't want to have secrets in version control, and because you have different people working on the same bits and pieces that need access to that. But if we just do it encrypted locally, every single thing you can deploy can have access to its own local state just then and there. It doesn't need to have all the other state, and it simplifies the whole model tremendously. Right. Yeah, so I think it deserves revisiting this thought. And I mean, there is some warranted conspiracy theories on like why this never did make its way in is because HashiCorp didn't have an incentive to do that, because that's one of the reasons you use HashiCorp Cloud, is for the state backend. And that's also one of the things that locks you into the product. As soon as your state is kept in the cloud, HashiCorp Cloud, it's very difficult. It's very cumbersome to move out of there.
Isaac brings up a pretty good point that I was also going to bring up, just like around locking when you have multiple users working on the same Terraform. I think if you store it in a thing like GitHub, where you have like this localized state, how do you do locking at that point?
So it comes down to the CI pipeline, same as how you do locking there, maybe merge queues, for example.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
But there is one thing that isn't necessarily solved here through the Git. It's simplified by having fewer things modify the Git, but if you have two pull requests modifying exactly the same thing and one merges, that applies. Will the state of the second, well, I guess the merge queue also helps maybe solve that.
And Git has a native mechanism for resolving conflicts.
Yeah, I don't want to have you're not wrong, but I really don't want to be in the business of resolving JSON file conflicts.
I mean, they don't need to probably be as detailed as they are right now, like the way that they write them. Like if you could redo this a little bit, but the other thing is like you're saying you don't want that to be the case, but how many developers do you know that just deleted the lock file and went in and edited state and did a bunch of other things because two people like made a modification at the same time and it didn't happen exactly as we wanted it to happen, right? So I don't think that we're necessarily introducing that much more craziness than kind of what already exists out there.
Yeah. I know that this has given me a lot to think about, though. I think it's an interesting notion now if this could simplify state management. We are at time. I want to be mindful of everyone's calendar. I had two more minor announcements, so I'll just bring them up next week. And with that said, thanks everyone for joining Office Hours. We will be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/cloudposse and subscribe. We also have a number of other links you can check out while you're at it. If you're curious about working with Cloud Posse, go to cloudposse.com/quiz, book a meeting with me directly. We syndicate our Office Hours as well as a podcast. Go to podcast.cloudposse.com and a newsletter where we share all of these cool links that we come across delivered to your inbox every week. Go to newsletter.cloudposse.com. Again, newsletter.cloudposse.com. Thanks, everyone. See you all next week. Same time, same place.